So, Tom, you sent me an article about British B-movies. And according to the article, back before the 70s for sure, maybe before the 60s in England, the way movies worked is you had your feature-length film, but you also had a B-movie that was usually a little less than an hour. And when you bought a ticket to the movies, you kind of saw both. You watched both this feature film and the B film. And you said, hey, these B films, which eventually fall out of popularity, are possibly similar to the micro-budget films we're talking about on Keep Making Movies. I didn't know if you want to just talk about that a little bit.
Sure. And so the article we're referencing here is, it's just something I was pulling up, was reading articles on lower budget movies. It's by Laura Mayne, M-A-Y-N-E. And it is from the Historical Journal of Film, Radio, and Television. Her article title is, Whatever Happened to the British B-Movie? Micro-budget filmmaking and the death of the one-hour supporting feature in the early 1960s. She's covering, this is from 2017, she's covering that period in British cinema, specifically in the early 60s, really from the 40s to the 60s, in which you start to see the end of the B-movie. She kind of brings up the point that...
Oh, and just to be clear, we're not talking like sci-fi B-movies. These are a very specific British thing, not what you think of when someone says, oh, it's a B-movie. Like,
it's literally a
shorter
a
film. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Because this is where the concept of the B-movie comes from the late 1920s and into the 60s, you would never just buy a ticket for one movie. You would always have the A feature and the B feature, just as you would with a record, the A side and the B side. And the B side usually was not the best of the two songs, but you got something else. And that was the same thing with these B-movies in England. And what's interesting is looking at the different studios as she does, and they were made on these incredibly small budgets of, this is in the 1950s, from between 10,000 and 25,000 pounds per movie, which even adjusting for inflation is an incredibly small amount. And the idea was that you really would hire a few writers, maybe even like one writer and a few directors, and you would just churn out these kind of like mostly crime films. And they're like an hour long, they're shorter, and they would use either crime or horror, and they would use whatever they had from the A film and write their scripts around those limits. And so you would have, they would tell the writer, okay, we have a submarine set, and we have a mummy prop. Make a movie that involves a submarine and a mummy that's an hour long. And most of the movies that are successful are horror or crime, so the subject must be horror or crime. And it has to be an hour. And these movies would, if they were made within a week, would be under budget and then make money. If it was over, typically, then they would lose money and have trouble distributing. What ends up happening is people actually don't really want these things, so they're perfectly happy to pay money for just the A feature and then go home. But I thought that was interesting listening to how a studio would basically do what these independent filmmakers are doing in the early 2000s up to our most recent movie in this season. I think it's 2022, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. And they're doing kind of the same thing. What we talk about on the show a lot is limitation as being a handmaid into creativity, right? It's the kind of the mother of creativity, rather. And it's interesting with this article is that that sort of spirit seems to have existed also in a studio system, where the limitations actually were more strict in a certain way, even though they had a studio to work with. And the reason being, it's like, well, you have to be profitable, which a lot of these movies we're looking at really don't have to be profitable. They just have to get out there. So these movies have to be profitable, and you have to use these items, right? It's like a mystery box of things. Can you write a movie? Open the mystery box and see. Yeah, exactly.
So I'll agree that these British B-movies had limitations similar to some of the movies we've done here on the first season to Keep Making Movies. But I think that may be where the likenesses stop.
Mm-hmm.
What I really like about the micro-budget films that we're exploring and keep making movies is I feel like the directors got to do exactly what they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't told, go get a, or we have a submarine and a mummy, you need to use the submarine and mummy. They still built the sets. Now, they were limited with their budget, but the stories that they wanted to tell and the ideas that they wanted to express were very much their own and not dictated by whatever the A movies, you know, it wasn't just the A movie, right? It was a combination of whatever A movies were.
It's whatever. Yeah. And, yeah. I mean, this is
leftover props or whatever. Was
yeah. Whatever's there still in the studio.
Whereas the modern micro budget films, especially the ones that we're going to explore and keep making movies, it's not dictated by what's around. It is what the film creators, at least I believe, what the film creators wanted to create.
They wanted to create. I think they are still limited by budget.
They are, but I can imagine, you know, the B director in Britain in 58 or whenever, if he had an idea that he wanted to do, it didn't matter because he had to work with,
mm-hmm.
you know, if he had an idea, like if he wanted to shoot Coherence or something similar to Coherence, could he try to make that work on a submarine with a mummy? Like, I don't think that was the approach, right? They looked at what they had and then wrote a script around that, not wrote the script they wanted and then had to cut back because of the budget.
Yeah, I mean, that might be the case. I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's, for them, it was more along the lines of, can you get this done quickly? Right? That's how you save money in these systems, because you already had the studio space. You were working in a studio system. And so it's, okay, we have these few days free. Can you get this done in time? So I think if you had a script like Coherence or something like that, and you could say, yeah, we could get this done in 4 days. We could film it all in 4 days. You don't have to change much in the studio for us to do that. It'll be way under budget. They would be happy with that. And
do you think that's how the directors went? It was a passion project?
No, I don't think so. No, because it's the same guy. So they're just like churning out movies. They're doing dozens of them. So it's not, this is a major difference, right? It isn't
right.
a passion
yes. okay.
project.
Great. Yep.
Yeah, I agree with you there that it isn't a passion project. But what you see in the transformation of the bees into the independent movie thing, if you want to call it that, and she points this out with the reemergence of United Artists, that studio. United Artists, we all know, was a independent studio made by Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, D.W. Griffith, Mary Pickford, someone else they worked with, and it was really to give the artists the authority and not studio bosses or businessmen. This works for a little while. Eventually, they more or less fold. United Artists comes back in the late 1950s, and the plan of United Artists is really interesting, which is we're going to be the studio without the studio. We're just going to fund creative people to do what they want to do, and the limit is going to be budgetary, because that's what we are. We're the funders. And they're still going to be United, so it's not going to be these big budget movies. It's going to be probably larger than micro budget, but still that idea of you're limited. We're going to combine passion, but financial limits. But that comes out of this like kind of B movie culture that's going on in England at the time.
I'm still wondering if those dots can be connected because of the passion. If there's no passion with the British B directors, I agree. Maybe some of the techniques and maybe some of the, philosophies that were used because they're cost effective. But I still think, at least from, reading the article and then watching the micro budget films, I don't know if I'm too familiar with the United Artists films in the late 50s, early 60s, but I'm struggling to connect those dots the same way you are, Tom.
Yeah, fair enough. And I think that major difference probably is this individual passion that these people are doing. Yeah, a lot of these people seem to be right out of film school or have not gone to film school, and they somehow gotten their hands around some money and are ready to go.
Put movies together. Keep making them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I get your point there. I think that there is a natural connection between resource depleted films, right? And I think we probably can see similar things in terms of certain qualities, right?
So, well, let's do that, Tom. In between seasons here, why don't we pick a British B movie, and why don't we pick a United Artists movie, and let's you know, either connect the dots or see how the dots aren't connected from the 40s up through our micro-budget films. How does that sound?
That sounds great. Yeah, we could do keep making movies old school.
All right, audience, get hyped for a micro season of keep making movies
old school.
Old school. What is that? What is old school? I don't even It's old school, you know, old school like the old school.
Sounds
we'll see
good.
You next week, audience, hopefully with the British B film.
You can rate and review this show anywhere fine podcasts are available. For those viewing in YouTube land, if you haven't already, please like this video, subscribe to the Talking Studios channel for all our exciting content, and follow us on social media at Talking Studios. Check out other shows by Talking Studios, including Talking Pictures Trivia, where we explore movies through trivia, Limited Lexicon, where we play through text-based adventure games, Get the Point, where we slowly reveal a movie poster and try to guess which movie poster it is, and Adapt It, where we explore adaptations in various forms. Got a question for us? Call the Talking Studios hotline at 201-467-8679 and leave a message. It may be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Keep Making Movies, wherever fine podcasts are found.
Wow, Talking Studios. Next week, we'll be discussing Pier 23. Tom, how was your watch?
I thought this was a delight. It is clearly riffing off of the Maltese Falcon, the more famous version of the Maltese Falcon, the John Huston version. And it is also like two television episodes. It's about 60 minutes long, and there's two distinct plots that don't have anything to do with each other than they have the same hero in both. And it's really kind of corny, and it's really funny, and it has a bunch of lines that you just have to write down as you're going along, because they're too good to not write down as you're going along. I actually had to stop the movie and be like, I can't let these things go by without writing them down. I'll start this again because, you know, I'm without pad and pen. And I had a good time. It's completely serviceable entertainment. It is easy. It's kind of chipper. I think 30 minutes per plot is about what this can stand, and it's about what it gave. How about you, KJ? How was your first impression?
Yes, I completely agree, Tom. So this was the first watch for me. I'd never heard of this style until you had brought up the article. But like you say, it was a blast to watch. And a lot of it was just waiting for the next... are they similes? Do we call them similes? Are they metaphors when...
Oh, yeah. They're similes.
They're similes. Mm-hmm. Yes, waiting for the next simile. Completely entertaining. Like you're saying, light watch. You really captured this quote-unquote movie in a nutshell. Audience, if you have an hour, I would go check it out. It was a lot of fun. It was kind of like watching, I don't know, Everybody Loves Raymond, right? There was no... It was light, fluffy, easy.
Nothing like that.
No?
Like Everything But He Loves Raymond?
Yeah, you're just waiting for the next funny thing Raymond's going to say, or maybe the...
Oh, band. Okay, I see. I was like, this is... It's not a family comedy.
Oh, no, yeah. No, not in plot, not in structure, but in how much attention you need to give it and how it'll
That's
keep
true.
Your attention.
Yeah, it feels like a detective noir sitcom.
Yes, that is
like
a great
episodic of a detective noir. Mm-hmm.
Pier 23 is available on YouTube at the time of this recording.